the OTB Podcast Network.
Okay, delighted to say that Dublin manager Mick Bohan is back with us on the show. Good morning, Mick. How are you keeping?
I'm great, thank you. I'm good form now.
So this is year number five. How big a decision was it for you to come back and give it a crack for a fifth successive year?
It wasn't a difficult decision at all. I probably decided late in the year that if the county board an agreement was an agreement, I would be returning because, first of all, the lateness of the competition, well knowing that now obviously we would have anticipated that this year's competition was going to start a little bit earlier, but that's neither here nor there now. But I'd be very aware of the fact that handing over a group like that at a late stage and for someone else trying to come in this environment would be the wrong thing. And after the years we've had together, they're such a good group. You'd only want the best for them going forward. So whenever that time is that we feel it's the right time to get off the treadmill, we'll do it.
Yeah, it doesn't seem like it would have been a good idea, especially given how well last year went. And I guess this head of steam that you might have built up going into a year like this, when maybe there's not a whole pile of time for other teams to readjust and for maybe the gap between yourself and the rest to close that much.
Yeah, I'm not sure the gap is that big, to be honest, because, I mean, if you even look at last year's championship, like in all of the games we played, every team we played was in touching distance, and only going down the straight did we pull away, and probably a little bit fortuitous in the Donegal game. The Armagh game was really tight, and obviously they showed great character to turn the game around, and then going home, down the last 10-minute stretch, we probably put a bit of daylight, but they got a sin bin. The Waterford game during the group stages, even though we were probably missing a couple of players with injuries, it was still a very competitive game, and it wasn't one that we were actually just able to take the foot off the pedal on. And obviously Cork in the decider are as they always are. So, but we have genuinely a unique group at the moment, and I've been lucky enough to be involved with some really good teams over the years, but just the quality of the leadership group that we have, and they're at that stage in their career where every time we see them play, it's something that you'd appreciate, because we don't know how long more we'll have them.
When you mentioned that leadership group, is that something that you come into the setup and there's not much you can actually do to affect how strong the leadership group is, or is that something you've had to work to cultivate over your 4 years so far?
Yeah, like at the start, they probably would have been a terribly quiet group. They mightn't necessarily have taken ownership of the thing, but, you know, with a little bit of direction, we've handed over the reins. And I would safely say in my fifth year, most of the big decisions are coming internally. And as all we're trying to do is facilitate it. And I suppose that's the success in that, you know, they've learned to do that. Those skill sets were within them. It was just trying to cultivate them. And that leads for a particularly content environment, because if they're the decision makers, well, ultimately, we're living off their decisions. So that's a nice place to be.
As a coach then, Mick, how much has that been a learning experience for you, the human side of running a team like this? We were just chatting on air before we clicked record here about how you're known as a great skills coach, for example. Was the human side something that you had as well, or is that something you've had to work on as well as the straight-up football coaching over the last few years?
No, definitely something I would have had to work on. And this group have probably opened my eyes to that, and probably, as you get older in years and even watch your own kids grow up, you learn a lot more about the other side of life, because even trying to distinguish that for a player between your identity as a footballer, not being your true identity. If you have a bad game, doesn't mean that you're a bad person, or if you don't make the cut on a county squad, that doesn't define you as an individual. And trying to actually say, make people aware of that, that's not something that I would have been probably hugely aware of over the years, but certainly now, I mean, even this time of year, like obviously it's a little bit different at the moment because we're not in a position to run trials and that type of stuff. But we did call in a few players that people had made us aware of to try and see if they could develop over this lead into the National League. But we never cut our squad last year, which is something we always do. But just with the climate, I just didn't think it was the right thing to do. It certainly wasn't a humane thing to do because we weren't aware of everyone's journey. Like some people struggled, other people needed the group environment to be in a good place. So we carried essentially 38 or 39 players, which was a large squad. We wouldn't normally do that. And it's difficult to do it. And it's very difficult to keep that number of players content. But because of the pandemic and access to going training, which obviously was something that we were massively appreciative of because a lot of people didn't have those opportunities, it was an outlet for the group. And so, you know, without trying to make ourselves out to be Padre Pio or something like that, we genuinely were doing a service to our community or to our city by facilitating that. But I think the group really appreciated it. And it's not I look now, you know, in a couple of weeks' time, and we have to cut the squad, the numbers down a bit just to make sure that it's operable. But it's an awfully tough time because, I mean, you're not just telling somebody that they're not with you, you're telling their family and their friends and the hopes that are built up around it. And that's definitely something that I've become way more aware of as a coach.
Yeah, I hadn't even really considered that last year, that essentially somebody who doesn't make an inter-county squad for a huge part of this pandemic, telling them that they're not part of the squad kind of takes away their avenue to sport, full stop.
Completely. And it wasn't, in normal circumstances, you go back to your club or whatever. This was end of nothing. So their outlet was gone. So genuinely, on a humane front, it was the wrong thing to do, even though from a point of view of logistics and finance and all the things that are involved in the thing, it wasn't the right thing to do. But I think they got rewarded, and I genuinely would feel that they appreciated what took place.
When you mentioned there a few moments ago about the identity of a footballer versus the identity of the individual in your squad, how hard is that to actually live in reality? Because everybody involved in sports teams bloody care about the outcome of what is happening. They care about winning and losing at the weekend. How do you manage to create that separation?
Well, it's funny. The first part of that answer to that question is it's terribly difficult, right? But I'll give you a conversation I had with a player during the summer. I told her, as a daughter, I'd love her. But as a footballer, she drives me insane. And that's the separation, genuinely. You can have a really, really, really good person who you could be terribly fond of. But just because they don't make the cut or don't make the team, that doesn't mean that as a person you don't value them. And you're trying to get them to see that. And ultimately, I certainly spent an awful lot of my younger years been defined by football, feeling that I had to prove myself, you know, either as a player or as a coach, for people to accept me in a certain way. And now, I don't know, sometimes when you've been part of successful outfits, it might be very easy to say this. Now it doesn't bother me. I actually, you know, even from a point of view of judgment, like, I remember when I got back involved with the girls in 2017, and I picked up a paper, and the statement on it was Mick Bowen's second stint involved after failing to land the All-Ireland in 2003. And I remember thinking, isn't that incredible? In 2003, we were beaten by a Mayo team that were arguably better than us in an All-Ireland final. So does that mean you're actually a failure because you lose? Mm. Or how do we judge people? And I give a lot of coaching courses around the country to clubs and development squads, and I consistently tell people that you should not be judged on winning or losing, but you should be judged on what you achieve out of the group that you have. And sometimes you do not have a group who are capable of winning the competition, but that does not mean you're a failure, nor does it mean that they're failures. So all of those things, is all you can do is consistently repeat those messages. And I've got to a stage in my coaching career, and I say this definitely based on the fact that it is easier when you've been successful. Like, I mean, even small things, which is quite interesting. Obviously, I'm involved with a women's team at the moment, but I don't see them as a girls' team or a women's team. I genuinely see them as a football team. I couldn't care whether they're girls or boys. I've three girls and a boy myself, so that doesn't bother me. I actually just see that I'm going out to coach a game. But I'd bat for them. I'd fight for them the exact same way as if they were a fellas team. And that includes standards around the country. When I go into a grounds and somebody thinks it's okay that you could be delayed by 20 minutes, or you don't have access to two changing rooms, you know, where a lads team would have, I don't accept that. Not because I'm fighting the cause for girls football, but because there's a standard that we should be adhered to all of the time, regardless whether it's male or female. And indirectly, then you're obviously raising the standard for your group. So I'd approach the whole identity between a player and a human being in the same way. It's not that I just say it. That's actually part of me now. So I live it out, and you know, I try and constantly pass on those messages, and you know, it eventually will rub off on people, I think.
Do you have that headline about 2003 pinned up on the wall somewhere at home?
There's a bit of a dog in me. It's back here in the memory bank. There's lots of lessons that are certainly implanted at this stage.
Mick, could I just ask, like, this is fairly open in terms of all the different parts of you as a coach, and maybe even as a human as well. How do you generate fresh ideas? How do you constantly keep either what you're giving to the team, what you're giving to yourself, fresh and new on a constant basis? I'm not sure, is it reading? Is it listening? Is there anything you do that keeps your ideas fresh?
There's a couple of factors in that. First of all, you would be amazed the amount of people around the country who would make contact, send books, send coaching courses, send video clips of stuff they tried out and whatever else, because they're, I've never put out anything on YouTube, but there's a lot of coaching courses that I've done up on YouTube that people have videos. So people then share, because they're, and I love that idea anyway. It's John Morrison, who I would have been very, very friendly with. That was his ethos, that you share your ideas, right? So that's something that has actually started to happen since I got involved with inter-county teams. But the most important factor, I had a conversation with somebody last week who's essentially starting their journey, and they made contact through LinkedIn, and they were amazed that I had responded, and I was making the point, why wouldn't I? Just because you don't have a name, or you're not a name at this point in time, how do you think the rest of us learned? Like, I coached with Jerry McCall. He was one of the first managers I worked under the development squads. I worked with Niall Moynagh and Sean Boylan and Sigerson teams. I've obviously worked with Jim Gavin. You go down through the learnings. John Morrison, who was a mentor for me for so many years, the learnings of these people was just substantial. But the key factor that I've picked up over the years is having quality people around you. And I've got, every year I've mixed it up with coaches. I mean, I've a fabulous coaching staff beside me, but we've used people from basketball, we've used people from rugby, we've used people from Gaelic games, we've gone to the group themselves. So that learning, trying to constantly just, I mean, oftentimes it's the same message, but you're genuinely trying to freshen it up, or it's extending the play, or making it better, like even though you thought you'd have cracked, that there was actually weaknesses to it, and those challenges. So that freshens it up. And equally, when we started off, we were telling the players what to do all of the time. Now we're initiating an idea, but then they're the noise, they're the discussion point around it. They're the ones who are picking holes with it, whether it's right or wrong, or what they see works off it or doesn't. So all of that changes the environment constantly, which obviously makes it fresh.
Right. Is LinkedIn like a hothouse for coaches at the moment in terms of discussion?
Well, I think the pandemic was a hothouse for coaches. Now, I'm not a fan of Zoom calls, and I did a couple of online things for different counties over it, and I hate that lack of interpersonal contact, because that's what gives me my buzz as a coach. But certainly LinkedIn it has made people accessible to you that you may not have thought were accessible before. My experience in coaching has always been the top people give you their time. That has definitely been my experience.
Yeah, and I've seen as well, not that you blow your own trumpet here or anything, but that since people have come back training, I've seen on social media, you've been out coaching different kids around the county. I'm not sure, is that a long list of people who try and get in touch with you on LinkedIn, and you've got a list as long as your arm almost of different seminars you need to get to around the county? But I presume you're a man in relatively high demand.
But it's brilliant. 2 years ago, a guy, and I won't name the county because it'll be wrong, but in the East Coast, a guy who was involved in an under 13 girls final got in touch with me, and he wanted me to come down to give the pre-match speech for the final that they were in on the Saturday. I was there trying to tell him that my pre-match would have nothing other than a disastrous effect in the squad, right? That it was a situation whereby, so we put a good, and I didn't want him to feel that we were dismissing him, but I was trying to let him understand that, honestly, if you got in Jose Mourinho, it wouldn't make a difference, right? That your message is key. So you're the one that they've entrusted themselves upon. So it, those words from you at that stage. And so he asked, what should I say? And I said, I'll give you something that we came up with on our second year with the group that they love hearing, and we still use it to this day. And the whole of the first year, I would have hit the girls on their standards weren't high enough. They're not executing the skills to the level they should be. If you want people to come and watch you play, then you must get the standards to a higher level. And our second year, by the time we got to championship, we came up with a phrase where we said, we can't wait to watch you play. And they saw that as the biggest compliment that they have been given off us. So I said it to him, tell your team you can't wait to watch them play.
So it's a transportation from the, why would people come to watch you play, to I can't wait to watch you play. And that's a journey you go on then.
That exactly was it. So we couldn't wait to watch them play because we were proud of the stage that they had got. So that was recognition.
It's remarkable, because I remember we had a chat about 14 months ago on the show, Mick, and you were talking kind of along that theme about the 2019 final and how you were a little bit disappointed about the final in 2019 because it wasn't a great spectacle, and maybe in 2020 things could be different. So at this juncture, had people been allowed to come to the stadium last December, do you think they would have been more enthused with the product they got in the final last year, or have your concerns kind of been allayed over the course of the last 12 months?
So it was a decent enough final, but it still didn't get to the level that I would have hoped that we could get to. Certainly from a point of view of the spectacle, and obviously people weren't there and they may have been not in the same view. The Donegal game was a ferocious battle. And essentially after 4.5 weeks of preparation, we couldn't get over the intensity that the game got to. The pitch of the battle was serious that day. And equally the Armagh game, it really hit a high note. So you feel that. When you're in the arena, you feel it. It's not something you look back on afterwards and you go. But ultimately, we had five championship games. No league games, obviously league in February and March until they got pulled. But So we went from nothing. We actually had two challenge games into a championship season. And it's very difficult to reach the levels that you're capable of. And that's for everybody, not obviously for us. So 19 was a disappointment. Yeah, that one will still sit in the craw. And, you know, I suppose isn't a lovely thing to be able to win a competition and still be disappointed with the performance that you give. But genuinely, and I suppose this is probably success in a coaching department, but genuinely, we are judging our games now on the level of performance they give on a constant basis, whether it's an in-house game, whether it's a training session. And obviously, the outcome is important. But and it's very easy to cliche this whole thing and say, you know, the whole thing of, you know, on consistency, and we judge it on a barometer of you do and you don't, because ultimately passion and heart and grit and all of those things, as I keep telling our S&C coach, there still hasn't been a machine made to measure any of that stuff. But I just feel this group, they still haven't hit the notes they're capable of. And that's, maybe we never will, but it's certainly something we're searching for.
I think that relationship between you and that S&C coach is one we need to drill down to into some other time. That sounds like a fascinating little subtext to your squad. One other thing I did just want to ask, though, just on that topic before we wrap, is the tension that surely exists, having that mindset. Because last year, if you're looking at, say, the Cork performance in the second half of the All-Ireland final, as a neutral, you might say that Cork didn't put on a great spectacle. You would say, I suggest, that you kept Cork to 2 points and it was a sensational defensive showing from Dublin. So I presume that there is a tension there between wanting a great spectacle and also wanting to be teak tough in defence, for example.
There was a couple of things happened in that game, first of all. Firstly, Cork started off and scored an outstanding goal, right, and they put us on the back foot. These are all learnings of a squad. Like, definitely on days gone by, that would have hurt this group, and they may have panicked and, you know, oh, here we go, Cork. Even at half-time, there was never that mentality. It was a matter of, we're actually creating more opportunities than Cork, we're just not finishing. So we need a little bit more composure. So that was one of the things. Secondly, we certainly felt we'd more in the tank, and that was a factor going down the straight. But this is the part, this is the part where I still see that the lads' game and the women's game haven't got to. I didn't pick up one report after the game from any journalist that spotted what happened. Sinead Goldrick moved from one side of the field to the other, and she negated a key player for them, Arla Finn, but she took the game by the scruff of the neck. Mm. Now, we took her off Ciara O'Sullivan, who was obviously a key player for them, and we put Siobhan McGrath on her, right? We also took off Sinead Ahern, who's been a massive figure for this group since we started. And in my time, it's the first time we've taken her off the pitch where we had to. Where we didn't have to, you know, as a situation where she had been injured in the past. But all of those things brought a life. Now, 2 years ago, Sinead Ahern not on the pitch, us conceding early scores to a Cork team who were in control, you would not have seen that response. So that's the life of the team. But Aoife Cain moved from one side of the pitch to the other with Goldie. She scored the first point of the second half, so she put her foot down. So all those changes happened. We moved, as I said, Goldie off, Ciara O'Sullivan, McGrath onto her. And they had a massive knock-on effect because players came to life. So all of those things just coincided at the one time.
Yeah, and it was an unbelievable second half showing from you that day. So it is Cork again on May the 30th, but not before Waterford, which is your first game of the league. How many times does five in a row get mentioned, Mick? Is it different to the men's setup because it's been done in the women's game before, or how are you approaching that as boss?
Yeah, that's I don't know. Is it Kerry won 8 or 9? Jesus, that's are even scary. And obviously Cork won 5, and there was a break for a year and think, did they win six? Obviously it's going to be mentioned. I don't think it'll be mentioned in the same way, because obviously the lads one was a historic journey. Nobody had done it before. From our point of view, these last 2 years have been most unusual for everybody. So been back playing the games at the moment. There's a genuine excitement about, you know, around the group, given the opportunity. And I think so many people are aware at the moment, like, I mean, we all know people who've lost loved ones. We all know people who've lost employment. We all know people who are struggling mentally, you know, because of the pandemic. And so with all those things going on in society, in the last lockdown, I think people were nearly afraid to let themselves go in any form, even to show other people they were enjoying themselves, even though they were been given the green light to do it. This time it's a little bit different in that there's a massive appreciation for being allowed to do what we're able to do. But there's also now a recognition, the fact for the next couple of weeks until we get to the next stage of this, that we've been handed an opportunity again to try and do something for society. Two of our three games are televised, the Páirc Uí-Chaoimh game, I think, and the Thurles game. And that is something that we really, really are proud of and we take ownership of, that there's a duty on us to provide a level of entertainment for people when they're watching until they get out of this. And that's probably, it was a new learning curve, because you never had to go through that before. It was never that level of expectation for you.
Yeah, I can imagine. But it's been obviously an incredibly successful few years. Mick, very best of luck for the season ahead. Hopefully season 5 goes as well as the previous 4 for you. Great chatting to you as ever, Mick Bowen. Thanks, Mill.
Thank you very much. We'll be right back.